individuals that eat higher fiber foods or just diets in general have a more diverse gut microbiome, more diverse, you know, populations of that gut bacteria. And we know that more diversity in your gut actually equals better gut health, but also better health overall.
Welcome back to This Little Life, an impromptu and lively discussion diving into the big and little issues of parenting and beyond. Well, we all heard the saying, happy wife, happy life. But here's another one for you. Happy gut, happy child. Okay, so it doesn't rhyme, but we think it's just as important. And today, we're joined by Dr. Anna Garber. She's a naturopathic doctor and her passion is children's health. She believes that good gut health early in life sets a strong foundation for our adult health. So what does good gut health in our children look like and how can we achieve it? And what is the connection between gut health and mental health? Well, there's certainly a lot to cover today, so join us as we get to the heart, or should that be the gut, of this very important topic. So Anna, thanks so much for joining us today. You're a naturopathic doctor in Canada, of all places, so thank you for joining us from far, far away. I'm really keen to kind of just understand how you got into this field of work. It's such a fascinating area. I mean, we're all sitting here today saying this is going to be such a great topic, so would love to hear how you got into it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's truly an honor. And I would love to kind of dive into my progression to this field. I would say that I didn't even know naturopathic medicine existed for a good portion of kind of my schooling. And I was doing my master's degree. I had always wanted to pursue medicine in some kind of form. I really truly felt that that was my calling, but I didn't really align with the conventional medical sphere here in Canada. And honestly, it was just one day I just Googled natural doctor. And then all of a sudden, this like naturopathic medicine world opened up to me. And it really just opened up my search and research into this particular medicine, learning that it was accredited in North America, both in Canada and in the United States, that it was a regulated profession, which is something that really, really appealed to me. And then kind of honestly, the rest is history. I went to school, I got my degree, I got all my licensing, and that really kind of embarked on my journey to this profession. And I am so incredibly blessed and truly fulfilled to be a naturopathic doctor.
And is it, I have to ask, in terms of this field of study compared to obviously the more traditional medicine, I mean, is this still considered a fairly new area of medicine?
I mean, we use a lot of traditional practices in naturopathic medicine, in our schooling. But I would say, yes, it is definitely relatively newer, especially the research around some of our complementary and alternative options. There, you know, some of them have only really been researched in the last 10 to 15 years. And even in Canada, for example, with naturopathic medicine in terms of licensing, some provinces, you know, have only gotten licensed within the last few years, and some provinces are still not licensed. So, and very similar with the United States, there's certain states that are licensed and others that are not. So it is definitely a work in progress, I would say.
Okay, that's really interesting. And I think the other most intriguing part of your journey is obviously, you know, you have a great interest in children's health. And that all started from becoming an aunt. So can you tell me more about that? And who is this gorgeous child that inspired this wonderful practice of medicine that you're now currently in?
Absolutely. There's actually two now, but I can definitely go back kind of to the beginning. I became an aunt while I was in naturopathic medical school. And at that point in my schooling, I didn't really kind of have a focus or a calling to a specific area within medicine that I really felt aligned with. And I just gave myself the permission to go through school and just really learn everything and see kind of what area really felt like it was mine. And I became an aunt. My brother, who is 8.5 years older than me, we have quite a little bit of an age gap, but him and I are very, very close. And I became an aunt, my nephew, and I liked children, but I didn't really love children up to that point. But really becoming an aunt, seeing that, you know, this, my brother, whom I love so dearly, now has this, you know, perfect little being that he has to take care of. And, you know, me being a part of that as well, and seeing how, you know, my nephew interacted not only with me, but with his parents, with his grandparents. And it just really showed me how important those first few years in your life are, and how they can really mold so much of your personality, but also your health. And some of our research does show that as well. And, you know, those beginning stages really just sparked my interest as, wow, I can affect or help to positively affect children's lives early on so that they can grow and be wonderful, healthy human beings into adulthood. And that just really, you know, struck a nerve with me. And that was kind of the beginning of that. And I'm so, so blessed and so fulfilled to do what I do.
I mean, it really does resonate with me, because I started Little Oak for exactly the same reason. Do you know, understanding that, you know, those first couple of years of what they put, what they consume is so important. And, you know, looking at, obviously, breastfeeding is best, and we're the biggest advocates of this at Little Oak. But, you know, what surprised me so much was that as parents, you know, around the world, not just isolated to different countries, you know, the quality of formula that, you know, was available to families, you know, back 10, 11 years ago when I had my first, was pretty poor. I mean, you know, you look at all of these things, corn glucose syrup, maltodextrin, palm oil, all of these, you know, horrible ingredients that were going into these products that parents just willingly accepted, you know, which is why, you know, so committed to trying to make significantly better products. Because, like you, I kind of understood from my own son's experience that, you know, understanding what I was putting into his body was actually affecting, you know, just not outwardly on his skin and things, but, you know, also inwardly in terms of what we couldn't actually see. So I'm hugely interested in this field of topic that you're specializing in. So we've got lots to discuss, and I'm going to keep asking all these questions, because I feel like we're probably going to be here for most of the day at this rate. But one of the things that we know as parents, obviously, is that at some point we have worried about our children's digestion, you know, whether that be reflux or constipation or diarrhea, or even just a simple stomach ache. You know, those are some of the things that we see day in and day out. But, you know, what are some of the signs that might indicate a more serious issue with a child's gut health?
Yeah, I mean, I like how you said that it's very different concerns can come up, and that could be completely normal. But I would say that a sign of, you know, more serious issues are persistent issues. So if you're having persistent reflux, persistent constipation, persistent diarrhea, persistent gas and bloating, things that don't necessarily resolve on their own, and they're there daily or even weekly, can be signs of something of more serious going on that needs to be, you know, looked into, further investigated, and really treating that underlying cause. And a big, I would say the most important symptom that parents should look out for is pain. You know, it should not be, we should not have a painful digestive system, kids included. Now, this can be really challenging as parents, because, you know, depending on what age your child is, you know, they're still learning about their bodies. They're still learning about how it feels. And they are also learning about vocabulary. And they may not have the vocabulary yet to describe some of those symptoms that they are feeling. But even as parents watching your child, right, and looking at their body language, parents know their child better than anybody. And when they can see maybe that they're not feeling so well, you know, probing and asking some of those questions. And again, if you need some advice from a healthcare practitioner, it's best to kind of seek one of those out, because even some testing options can be available to investigate into some gut health issues.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, I think there's the question around who, you know, a parent will go and see is also fascinating, don't you think? Because I know that when, you know, again, just my own journey, you take a child to a doctor, a traditional doctor, not that there's any judgment here today in that space, but, you know, the first thing is to do is invariably, you know, give them medicines of some sort. But, you know, if you go to a naturopathic doctor or a, you know, more of the natural side of the space, like I did when my mother, you know, when I was 12 or something, she took me to an iridologist and a naturopath, and everybody thought we were all hippies at the time. But, you know, the advice that you get from those different health professionals is quite different, isn't it? So, you know, I suppose I'd kind of be interested to get your thoughts on who a parent should see first, sort of if they're concerned about those stomach issues.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would love a world where we all work integratively. I think we all have our strengths and we all have our limitations, and it would be so lovely to have, you know, an integrated space. If your child is experiencing acute and severe symptoms, you should definitely go and seek some emergency care, because, you know, depending on a practitioner, like there's limitations that I have. I can't run certain types of tests. I can't order imaging. I don't even for these patients. And sometimes your kid needs some of those to investigate into what's going on, especially if it is acute and serious. But some of our more chronic concerns, I would highly recommend seeking out somebody that's more holistic in nature, such as a naturopathic doctor. I think one of the wonderful things that I have with my patients that a conventional pediatrician doesn't is time. I see for that first initial appointment, I spend 90 minutes with a parent talking about their child. I ask a lot of questions, because for me, my role is to investigate and to put all those connections together. And I have, you know, really solved cases by asking lots of questions, because parents sometimes don't know what's important to disclose, and practitioners should be responsible for asking the correct questions. It's really like, you know, putting together a puzzle. It's kind of almost like what I see my role is. I ask all those questions. I try to put together the puzzle pieces, and I'm like, okay, this is what I think is going on. This is the mechanism. And then, you know, based on that mechanism, let's try, you know, X, Y, and Z to help kind of gut health. So kind of to answer your question, I would say it really, really depends. For more acute, serious conditions, I think you should, parents should go and seek out a conventional medical doctor, you know, somebody in emergent care who has the ability to run certain tests that maybe holistic healthcare practitioners are not. But if the issue is more, you know, chronic in nature, then if you do want to get to the root cause, you know, reaching out to somebody like a naturopathic doctor can really, really help.
And I think the other thing is also that preventative piece as well, isn't it? Because as I'm sitting here listening to you talk, I'm obviously thinking of my daughter who has a terrible sweet tooth. So I'm already thinking I'm going to get her lined up with you, because, you know, we all know that obviously, you know, diet and what we eat, particularly as children, has a significant impact on a child's gut health. And, you know, I suppose this is probably an obvious question in many ways, but, you know, what are those specific foods, you know, that or dietary habits that parents should be aware of or perhaps try and avoid with, you know, younger children, even through to, you know, tweens and teens?
Yeah. And like you mentioned, sugar, definitely high sugar foods is one that can disrupt gut health. It can disbalance the gut bacteria. It can promote the growth of, you know, certain bacteria, which may be harmful. So, you know, limiting high sugar foods would be really important for gut health. But I want to preface this by saying that it's unrealistic to follow, you know, dietary recommendations 100% of the time. And I never want to make parents feel guilty or even have shame around giving their kids sugary foods, right? It's okay. Once in a while, it's okay, but it should not be a staple. It should not be something that is in their diet, you know, every single day or even kind of on a weekly basis. You know, if you have a birthday party, let your kid indulge, let them experience, you know, that fun around that birthday party, but it should definitely not be a staple. And aside from high sugar foods, other two things, you know, to be a little bit more cautious around is, you know, just highly processed foods. A lot of processed foods, they have, you know, certain additives, preservatives, artificial ingredients. There are a lot of the times they're devoid in fiber. And those, again, can disrupt that balance within our gut, particularly with the gut microbiome. And also artificial sweeteners. A lot of our artificial sweeteners have been on the market for a relatively short period of time. I remember when I was in my undergraduate degree, we were learning about Splenda and how it was like the best thing for diabetics. And Splenda was fairly new-ish, yes, kind of around that time. And yeah, Now I'm reading articles about how artificial sweeteners can actually disrupt your gut microbiome and that it should really only be, you know, limited to individuals like diabetics. So it's very interesting how research kind of progresses around that time. But, you know, definitely artificial sweeteners is another thing to limit, things like aspartame and sucralose.
Well, a lot of even the new studies that have just come out, obviously, the warnings around it being, carcinogenic as well. So I'm, despite in my previous life working for one of those companies and others that used a lot of aspartame, I now think it's the biggest one to avoid in and amongst all the other things you've talked about. But so on the flip side then, Anna, tell me, what are the foods and the habits that, as a health expert in this space, you know, are you encouraging parents, you know, to get their children, you know, to eat, and what are those good health food practices that you would encourage a child, let's say Olive, 11 years old, to practice?
Okay, so let's maybe dive into foods first. So fiber is extremely, extremely important. I'm sure we've all heard about it, you know, high fiber foods, but why are fiber foods important for your digestive system? Fiber is a type of carbohydrate that is not absorbed by our gut. So we don't actually, you know, absorb it into our body, but it just kind of passes within our digestive system. And it has, you know, many roles. It helps to bulk up our stool. But one of the really, really important things is that it feeds our gut bacteria. And we have several studies that show that, you know, individuals that eat higher fiber foods or just diets in general have a more diverse gut microbiome, more diverse, you know, populations of that gut bacteria. And we know that more diversity in your gut actually equals better gut health, but also better health overall. So high fiber foods, really, really important. So what are those? You know, just whole plant foods, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes. Legumes are truly a superfood category of foods that, you know, I think everybody can use a little bit more of in their diets. And then aside from fiber-rich foods, another types of foods are probiotic-rich foods. And the reason why probiotic-rich foods are really good for our gut is that they actually put good bacteria into your digestive system. So foods like, you know, yogurt, kefir, fermented vegetables like sauerkraut, pickles, kimchi. I know not all it can be very challenging to get some of these into children, but even, you know, starting that conversation and letting them try it a few times to see if that's something that they could eat. And when it comes to dietary habits, the one thing, if you can remember one thing from our entire conversation today, it's diet diversity.
Okay.
What does that mean? Not eating the same thing every single day, rotating between different types of fruits and vegetables, rotating between different types of meats, different types of proteins, different types of fats. We see that, and this is something that I've been reading a little bit more of in the last year in terms of research, is the more diverse your diet is, the more diverse your gut microbiome is, the better your gut health. And that kind of goes into saying that you can't be 100% of the time. So, you know, allowing your kids to indulge every once in a while, it's okay because it's part of diversity, but also having that diversity within all those good foods is also really important. I see a lot of different patients in my practice. And sometimes some patients, you know, not only children, but some adults have quote unquote clean whole food diets, but they eat the same three things every single day. Their only vegetables are broccoli and carrots. Their only protein is chicken. Their only carb is rice. And then they struggle with gut health issues. And it's because all of those different types of food, foods, they have a very specific nutrient profile, right? And yes, they're good foods, but they may be devoid of certain nutrients because not every single food has all of the nutrients at good values. So having that diet diversity is really, really important to making sure not only you're getting all of those nutrients, but you're feeding that gut bacteria in different ways.
That's really fascinating because, you know, I do know a lot of parents that just cook the same thing. And I'm guilty of that as well, actually, to be honest, of doing the same thing because you just know your kids are going to eat it. And it's like, right, okay, this is a sure thing. If I put this on the plate, they will eat it. It's going to be easy. And I think, you know, I am fascinated because I think every parent would love for their child to be eating kimchi and kefir every day. I know, gosh, if I, you know, and I admire some of my parents that, you know, have children my age, they were, you know, their children didn't have sugar from very early on. You know, they were having all these fabulous things. And I used to sit there and think, God, that's a bit rough, isn't it? It's a bit kind of strict. But now I look and think, gosh, I wish I could turn back the hands of time and actually have conditioned my children to enjoy all these wonderful foods that are so good for them. But I didn't. And now we're kind of at that age where trying to introduce them to kefir and kimchi is near impossible. It would be a fairly hard undertaking. So how would, you know, that combined with obviously just the general kind of picky eaters that every parent has experienced, you know, what is your advice in terms of encouraging kids to try new foods and, you know, in the interest of better gut health for them?
Yeah, lots of different strategies. And here are some of my pointers.
I'm going to note every single one of these down. I'm literally going to take this home tonight and employ these.
Yeah. So first one, I know it seems really simple, but parents need to lead by example. You know, it's way more likely for your child to be curious around food, maybe even to be open to trying something new if you're doing the same. So leading by example is easier said than done, but can really, really help your children just be a little bit more open. Mm-hmm. Another thing is involving your children in the meal preparation. Kids are curious. And if they're there cooking with you, if you're explaining things, if they're measuring or pouring things, they are hopefully going to be a little bit more excited about the finished product and trying that because they were a part of that meal preparation. So, you know, getting your kids kind of dirty in the kitchen is definitely something that can help them become a little bit more open to trying that final product.
That's good advice.
Another thing is to offer variety, and not necessarily just variety in terms of the types of foods, but in terms of the way the food is cooked. Because I see quite a few children in my practice who have sensory issues and, you know, may not like mashed, but are okay with roasted, or prefer raw, but don't like boiled. So, you know, trying to cook foods different types of ways can allow your child to try that same food in a differing way to see if they like the texture specifically, not only the taste, but the texture of that particular food. Another one, and this is probably a tip that I hear a lot, is the way that you pair foods. So if you know that your child really likes carrots, serve them carrots with a new food that you would like them to try, because they're going to have that comfort around carrots and they may be a little bit more open to trying something new if they have something that's already, you know, comforting as their kind of safe food and whatnot. Another thing is, this is actually a recommendation from Ellen Satter. She is a researcher specifically around feeding children, and she really promotes serving meals family style. So what I mean by that is putting all the different, you know, dishes or components of a meal into separate plates in the middle of the dining table and allowing your child to make the decision of if that type of food or dish is going to hit their plate. Because if you already give them a plate with all of the different foods on there, the only choice they have is if they're going to eat it or not. But if you now give them a little bit more autonomy to choose, to allow them to choose to put that food on their plate, again, you may over time get them a little bit more curious around what's on the plates and get them to actually try that.
It's a really good piece of advice because if I think back 10, 15 years, I remember doing a study ourselves years ago around the importance of family meal times. So sitting around the table with your family and eating, but also having that interaction with food in the middle. So that's that feels like it's progressed a little bit in terms of gut health now in that context as well. So that's really interesting. Yeah, it always just feels like a little bit more extra work, doesn't it, putting in the middle, but it actually isn't. Do you know, I think we're so accustomed to having a plate of food given to us, but you're right, that communal sort of feeding time is actually significantly A, more enjoyable, but like you're saying, gives them that, that empowers them to make the decision around what they're eating and probably a little more courageous and curious, let's hope. I'm going to try that. I'm trying all these tonight.
And also brings the family together, right? Exactly like what you said, that social interaction and having, you know, a positive environment around food with having it together with your family can also be something that is encouraging for kiddos.
Fantastic. I love that. And tell me this for, I mean, we've obviously talked about dinner, but one of the things that every morning without fail, that kind of 7:30 a.m. when you're sitting there, what are we putting in our lunch boxes today, kids? Do you know, it's a kind of a nearly pulling your hair out moment before your day's even begun. What, you know, packing those lunches can absolutely be tricky, but, you know, from your point of view, what is the, you know, best looking lunchbox look like, you know, to encourage obviously that, you know, long-lasting energy and, you know, giving them those kind of nutrients that they need throughout the day to flourish and thrive and learn and play and all those sort of things.
Yeah, I think that the best that parents can do is to pack that lunchbox and the child will choose what they eat or not. But having a balanced lunchbox, I would say, is really, really important. So what does that mean? There's going to be some kind of carbohydrate there. There's going to be some kind of protein and also some kind of fat source. Because having that balance with those three macronutrients is really going to help sustain blood sugar levels. And that's really what's going to help that kiddo not have blood sugar crashes and have sustained energy throughout the day. So, you know, things like whole grains, as I mentioned before, are really important. That can look like, you know, things like whole grain bread, brown rice, quinoa, oats, for example, having some fruits and veggies, something colorful, and perhaps even, you know, cut up in fun ways that can really, you know, help encourage a child to eat it if it looks fun, right? Oh, look, mom used a cookie cutter. I have, you know, maybe hearts for apples. That can be something fun. And again, can encourage them to have that particular food if it looks interesting. And then, I mean, our fat sources, things like avocado or even nut butters. I know that nuts in school can be sometimes limiting in terms of what you can send around kind of our peanut allergies. But, you know, using some kind of nut butter, if you are able to, could be a really nice way to add in some healthy fats. But also their nuts are very calorie dense. So they can not only provide a good source of, you know, proteins and fats, but also they have those calories to keep our kiddos satisfied for longer.
That's a fascinating, and sorry, it's another area of huge interest to me around nut allergies. So the school of thought is that, you know, obviously there's children with severe nut allergies and others that perhaps should be introduced early so you can avoid having allergies over the long term. I know we're going a little off piste here, but what's your thoughts around that particular dietary challenge for many children and families?
It definitely could be challenging, and I haven't yet encountered in my practice someone with a severe peanut allergy. But as you mentioned, even the World Health Organization recommends exposing your child to highly allergenic foods such as peanuts earlier on, because that actually shows to decrease the risk of them getting that allergy later on. Now, of course, every child is different and family history definitely plays a large role into that. But even, you know, putting a little bit of like peanut butter on a child's hand, for example, as like an early exposure, or just a very, very small amount, and, you know, doing it a little bit more in a controlled setting can definitely help to explore that particular area.
Yeah, because I had in this situation a couple of months ago with a hazelnut interaction with a child, and, you know, having quite a severe reaction, and then going to a talk only a couple of weeks ago with another health expert in a similar space to you, who's recommendation was that at 6 months every child should have, you know, when they start having solids, that we, you know, you put peanut butter onto, you know, bits of, you know into their food in some form of capacity, so that you can address that potential nut allergy at an early age, which I was fascinated by, because having had to deal with a near anaphylactic situation, I was like, gosh, what would it have been different had she been introduced to nuts much earlier on in her life? But I mean, I suppose, like you said, there is a part of the family genetics that play a part in that as well.
Yes, absolutely. And I would say that given that family history, you know, maybe if a family has a very strong lineage of allergies, you know, giving a child, a 6-month-year-old, some of that may not be the best kind of recommendation, because as a parent, especially a new parent, if that child does go into anaphylaxis, it can be a very, very scary experience.
I can imagine. Yeah. Well, this is a 6-year-old, and that was scary enough. So don't want to do that anytime soon. One of the areas I did want to explore with you today, Anna, was the interaction between and the growing body of evidence around food and mental health. So one of the things that we have been looking at Little Oak is obviously the connection between a lack of protein in younger children, a lack of laying down enough iron stores, getting enough potassium and magnesium at a young age, that then leads to a higher level of anxiety or sort of mental issues, growth, you know, constraints at that sort of teen, tween age, and also, you know, impacts on IQ levels. So I'd love to understand your thoughts around that particular space.
Oh my goodness. That is definitely a big heated
No, it's just so fascinating though, isn't it?
It is absolutely fascinating. And there's so many complexities and areas, particularly around that. But let me speak to specifically iron, because this is actually an area that I'm extremely, extremely passionate about in my practice. And that's iron deficiency in children. Because as you mentioned, that we see from research that iron deficiency in children that is prolonged, isn't corrected, actually changes or affects adulthood in terms of cognition, in terms of IQ. So addressing and dealing that early on is extremely important. Unfortunately, here in Canada, we don't have universal screening guidelines for our pediatricians. Or family doctors to screen for iron deficiency in children. It's basically, you know, only something that is run for blood work if a concern comes up. But there has been some proposals in terms of the research community out of one of our research teams to suggest that this could actually be cost effective and something that we should do in children. So we'll see if that comes out. But specifically around iron deficiency, I see this quite a bit in my practice. And I will say something that comes up over and over again in terms of a correlation is mom being iron deficient in pregnancy. So if you as a mom have struggled with your iron stores in pregnancy, I highly recommend, especially at the 12 to 16 month mark, to check your child for iron deficiency, because your child is making their own blood iron stores from your stores as a mom. So if you're already deficient, it's much more likely for your child to be iron deficient as well. And particularly in children that have gut issues, because iron in general is a relatively poorly absorbed mineral. There's quite a few things that affect iron absorption, interactions with foods, and especially if you have some kind of gut issues going on, it's much more likely for iron to be low or and not to be well absorbed. So something that I am extremely, extremely passionate about. And I do really, really think that specifically around the connection between iron and gut health and mental health is kind of like a triangle and something that is, you know, a huge, huge topic, but really, really important, especially for the growth and development of children.
Yeah, it's a fascinating area and one that I'm, you know, very conscious of even with my children, because like you're saying, I was very low in iron with both of mine, and it does concern me. But, you know, I think it's certainly one of the things that's more widespread than we probably realize, and certainly an issue that we should be keeping an eye on. And the other ones I suppose I'm interested in exploring is obviously the ADHD and autism to a degree, but, you know, it certainly seems to be, you know, on the increase, certainly here in Australia. You know, how, you know, what do you see as the correlation between those conditions and diet? And, you know, what is your advice to parents who perhaps do have children that are suffering from those particular conditions?
Yeah, so diet is plays a huge role specifically in exacerbating ADHD and autism symptoms. It's not necessarily the cause, but it can really exacerbate some symptoms. And when you do some kind of dietary intervention, change your child's diet up, maybe put in some nutrients, vitamins, minerals that they're devoid of, it can really help improve those ADHD symptoms. Kind of going back to iron specifically and ADHD, we actually see that there was a study that came out actually several years ago that showed that kids diagnosed with ADHD actually had lower iron overall, and that when you supplemented their iron back into a normal range, their ADHD symptoms improved. So, you know, this shows how important, you know, diet is, because with iron, for example, a huge factor is intake, not only, you know, absorption as well, but if you're not getting enough iron through your food, for example, it's much more likely that you would become devoid. So especially when it comes to ADHD and autism, there's not a one-size-fits-all approach. Diet is so complicated. There's also, you know, every child is different in terms of certain foods that they can be sensitive to or intolerant. And that's why I would say it's really important to work with some kind of practitioner that is well-versed in this area, that will ask you lots of questions, that will put you on to some kind of personalized treatment recommendations, but then also have the follow-up with them, because it's not just about getting recommendations and then you're kind of out the door, but it's really important to follow the progression with your child and kind of make adjustments as needed, because health, especially for children with ADHD and autism, is truly a journey. And there can be lots of ups and there can be lots of downs, and parents need support.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And it's interesting, again, as you're talking that, you know, we spend so much time and energy and money, and me included, on, you know, tutors for our children and, you know, all the sporting investments that we make in them. But very little do we spend time on giving them access to people like yourself, where, you know, they can talk about the very thing that actually will help with their academic performance or their sporting performance. So there's a real need. I mean, as I said, I will certainly be booking some time with you and certainly Olive, because at 11 years of age, you know, this, you know, these things that you're talking about are all sort of very prevalent in her diet. And I assume I am not alone as a mum right now. Do you know, we have my colleagues here in the room nodding their heads around their children. We're all doing the best we can, but I'm sure there's some probably simple tips that we can employ to make our kids healthier and better for the the future. And one of the things we've just come through in the Southern Hemisphere here, and I think, you know, the Northern Hemisphere you're just about to embark on, is obviously the winter season again, and the dreaded colds and flus, of which they feel like relentless at the moment. Everybody's sick. And for a long time now, I've obviously espoused the virtues of echinacea, and I'm so excited that you also believe in the virtues of echinacea. I'm really really love you to share how echinacea, in the context of children's health and, you know, obviously trying to prevent those colds and flus in the season, those daycare visits when they come home at 2 p.m. and they're sick with sniffly nose. How can echinacea help us?
I love echinacea, especially for children, also for adults, but I absolutely love echinacea and I recommend it quite a bit in my practice. I love it because it's safe. Our human trials don't show many adverse effects with echinacea. It has been studied in both, you know, adults and in children. And what echinacea does, kind of from the research that I have participated in, is that echinacea helps to increase certain immune markers that are really important for kind of battling against those pathogens that we are exposed to. And what we see in the research with echinacea is that it can decrease the severity and also the duration of respiratory tract infections. And what's really important around the use of echinacea is that you are giving it right at the start of symptoms. Right? You're not really delaying it, because we don't see it working as well if you delay it. So as soon as you see your kiddos having those particular symptoms, that's a really good time to kind of introduce the use of echinacea. I also use echinacea in my practice for prevention of respiratory tract infections. There's one specific type of extract of echinacea that I use. It's called Echinacea Force. It's from a Swiss company called A. Vogel. And the reason why I like this extract is that they actually do research specifically on this extract of echinacea. So I do use it to help prevent respiratory tract infections. And I do see, you know, from feedback from my parents that their kids are not getting sick as often. Now, something that's really important around echinacea is that we shouldn't be using it more than 4 months at a time. And that's kind of what research also recommends. And the reason being is because it increases some of those immune markers, just think of it as it kind of poking your immune system, like kind of work better. So you don't necessarily want to be taking a herb all the time that's kind of poking at your immune system. And kind of what my recommendation around the use of echinacea for my parents is start, you know, kind of when they go back to school, do 4 months and then just give it a break for the rest of the year. And that seems to be a really kind of good strategy for preventing some of those respiratory tract infections. But also, you can definitely increase the dose when they are sick to just give them a little bit more support.
Interesting. So talk to me about that in the context of, let's say, going back to the story I shared with you before, a little six-year-old allergic to nuts, was quite a brittle asthmatic from a young age, but was literally on so many puffers and so many steroids and so many things from such a young age, you know, but eating a terrible diet, which we've addressed and started to introduce proper proteins and fresh fruit and taking out dairy and taking out gluten. And the response in terms of her, you know, respiratory piece and her asthma and all the eczema on all over her body has literally disappeared. So she only has the puffer if she starts getting, you know, a cough again every now and again, which is a phenomenal. I look at this and I think if there's not a great case study for the power of nutrition and food, you can't argue this one. Interested though in this echinacea, obviously during the winter months, she does get just little coughs, you know, regularly. Is, you know, would echinacea be a good place to introduce into this context?
So in children that have allergies, I would say that echinacea is something that I'm cautious around. Okay. Because in children that have allergies, their immune system is already heightened a little bit in terms of its function, right? It's reacting to all of these different types of allergens. So using something that is immunostimulating, such as echinacea, can actually put a little bit more fuel to the fire and not necessarily be helpful in that particular case. So I would definitely say in kids that have many allergies or are struggling with allergies, being a little bit of cautious around echinacea would be my recommendation. There's other things that you can do that are more immunomodulating, things like probiotics. We have lots of different types of probiotics that can be like TH2 to TH1 modulating. That can be a little bit more helpful in those particular cases. And that's a kind of goes back to there's definitely not a one size fits all approach and why it's so important to work with somebody that understands complementary and alternative options and asks the right questions. Because in this particular case, I would actually be a little bit cautious with using echinacea in this particular child.
Glad I asked the question. I would have been straight out and buying echinacea this afternoon. So I'm glad I asked that question. So one of the things I wanted to also cover, Anna, as we kind of come to the end of our discussion today, is kind of what I was referring to earlier about obviously your space of health study and expert is relatively new, if you will, in terms of how you've married medicine with the natural kind of aspects of treating health. You know, there's obviously studies out there that suggest that many patients, when they go to a traditional doctor, very rarely sort of admit to the fact that they're using, you know, natural therapies as a preventative measure. You know, do you think that that is something that is a positive thing in terms of obviously trying to, I mean, it's kind of like the old guard and the new guard a little bit in terms of, you know, getting sort of more traditional doctors to be more open and accepting of, you know, the natural way that people can address their health issues. You know, do you see that in your practice in terms of people being a little cautious in terms of how they, you know, respond to a traditional doctor versus somebody like you in terms of the natural space?
Yes, I definitely see this, especially in the community that I practice. You know, there are certain medical practitioners in our community that have certain opinions around us as naturopathic doctors, maybe from a lack of understanding necessarily what we do, or maybe, who knows, maybe their own opinions around us. So I have patients who will maybe be very cautious to disclose that they are seeing me or, you know, somebody else at the clinic that I practice because they don't want to jeopardize that relationship with their medical practitioner. And I find that just so sad, because I really hope for a world where we can work integratively. Us as naturopathic doctors, we don't disbelieve in conventional medicine. Conventional medicine has many strengths that we don't have in naturopathic medicine. But naturopathic medicine also has a lot of strengths that conventional medicine doesn't. And if we can just work together for the betterment of our patients, I truly think that we would have better health outcomes. That's kind of my jam.
Yeah, I think it's valuable. I mean, the reason I asked the question is because I am guilty of that myself. Do you know, there's a lot of the, particularly years ago when I was probably more involved in kind of taking the echinaceas and the astragalus and the, you know, the linseed oils and what have you, whereas I seem to have been, since becoming a parent, that seems to have fallen away because there never seems to be any time for all those wonderful things. But I do notice that when I sometimes say to particular doctors that, we have these, using these preventative things, they're like, oh no, that won't work. That won't work. But again, you know, I use the example of, you know, my son, which is the whole reason started Alok. I mean, he had the terrible skin condition. I took him to the doctors and they said, give him this thing and chemicals for his skin and these baths and things, which was, I just thought there's got to be a different way, which is really, you know, then started looking at the foods he was eating and changing that up and sort of, you know, within a couple of weeks, you could see the difference. So, you know, I think there's a lot of questions we should be asking when we get to a traditional or a conventional medical practitioner. They certainly are fabulous and they certainly have, you know, a wonderful way in treating our health, but a lot of more questions we need to ask, I would say. And then on that note, tell me if you had to give a parent like me or others that are listening today three tips in terms of how to improve their child's health or their gut health to ensure they thrive and grow and, you know, grow nice and strong to enjoy the world around them. What would those three tips be?
Sure. So the first one, my dietary tip is every meal should be balanced with carbohydrates, protein, and fat. Every single meal. So think of the balance, not in your overall day, but in every single meal. So that's my tip number one. My tip number two, which is I'm sure easier said than done, is no screen time 1 hour before bed for kids. They should be having, not be on any screens. They should be doing some kind of relaxing, activities to help them kind of wind down and really supporting that melatonin production once the lights go off, and screens kind of work against that. And then my third tip, which could be easy, is give your kids Epsom salt baths. This can be extremely calming for them. It's Epsom salts have magnesium in them. Magnesium is something that I see quite deficient in my pediatric patients that are constipated. And something as simple as an Epsom salt bath a few times a week can really help. Yes, getting magnesium through an Epsom salt bath is not going to be absorbed in your skin to the same level as if you take it orally, but it can still really help with constipation.
It's a really good tip, actually. I used to love Epsom salt. All these things I used to do. Now you're reminding me of all these great things. And tell me, in terms of then, from looking at the screen time piece, I was quite interested before we wrap up. What is that correlation between food and screen time and activity that you're seeing with children at the minute? Because we obviously hear the headlines around greater obesity, and I'm guilty of leaving my children sitting in front of their iPad for much longer than they should. You know, what does that relationship look like, and what is the risk in terms of this digital time for our children in terms of their ongoing health into teenagers and adulthood?
Yeah, I mean, that's again a loaded question, but usually when we are on a screen, we are sedentary, right? So especially with our children as well, the more screen time that they have, the more likely that it is that they aren't being physically active. So I completely understand that sometimes parents need to use screen time with their children, but really kind of focusing on not necessarily how do I reduce the screen time in kids, but thinking about how can we as a family be more physically active, take part in activities together that get us away from screens, and really just focus on that. And then naturally the screen time will kind of decrease on its own. And another thing is really, really important to set specific limits with children and abide by those. So, and this is something that you can sit down with your children, chat about, and set those limits themselves, and maybe do something fun to maintain those limits. Put like a cool little table on the fridge where you mark off every single hour that you have, or use magnets, for example. Get your kids involved in them sticking to their limits, and really educate them around why it is important for them not to be on screens. And again, really promoting that family physical activity time.
Fantastic. And just finally, I mean, I love your idea that you spoke about, we read about the idea of parents building on small, sustainable changes. So in everyday life, and obviously, but in your view, what's a realistic yet impactful health habit that busy parents can easily incorporate into their children's daily routine?
Yeah, I would say something that is really important to kind of get into your kids' routine is water intake. It's something that I would probably talk ad nauseum about with my parents. It seems so simple, right? But we're just not doing it. And sometimes us as adults don't do it as well. But being hydrated is so incredibly important. Making sure that your child has adequate water with them at all times, get them a fun water bottle, something that they enjoy, something that is easy for them to open, to pick up, make sure it's filled and it's always there. And also model you water, you drinking your water, so your child will drink their water. Again, I know it's something that's super, super simple, but it's those simple things are often the things that are overlooked.
It's really funny. I got a new water bottle and my son thinks it's pickle juice. So now he talks about pickle juice. He goes, "Mom, can I have a sip of your pickle juice?" But it's become this fun thing now. So adding in that fun element of whether it's drinking water or eating carrots or, you know, celery, whatever it might be, it's all very important. But Anna, tell me, really interested to know if for parents listening today, where can they find out more information about you and all the fabulous work that you're doing?
Yeah, you can find more about me on my clinic's website, junipernaturopathic.com. You can look more about what I've done in the past on my LinkedIn page and follow me on my Instagram, dr.annagarber.
Love it. Fantastic. Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of This Little Life. And we hope that everyone listening has found this discussion both enlightening and enjoyable as I have. And if you'd like to stay updated on our latest episodes and receive notifications about future releases, make sure you subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform, whether it's Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen. And don't forget to leave us a review and share this podcast with your loved ones. Your feedback and support mean the absolute world to us. And more importantly, if you have any suggestions for future topics or guests, feel free to reach out to us on at The Little Oat Company. We'd absolutely love to hear from you. So until next time, take care and take some time to enjoy this little life. And we'll catch you in the next episode of our podcast.